This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is poet, playwright, and essayist Amiri Baraka, who was formerly known as Leroy Jones. He's one of the key black literary voices that emerged in the 60s. The political and social views that have inspired his writing have changed as he's moved from bohemian to Muslim, black nationalist, and now socialist. Amiri Baraka attended Howard University, but he rejected the upward mobility he thought it represented. He was more at home in the bohemian life of Greenwich Village, where he moved in 1958, and wrote poetry, edited a literary magazine, and had his first plays staged. After the assassination of Malcolm X, the largely white artistic circles he traveled in seemed irreconcilable with his black-identified writing. He pulled out, moved up to Harlem, then across the river to Newark, New Jersey, where he grew up and continues to live. He changed his name as an expression of his deepening black identity. In Newark, he's remained active in creating and running black art centers and in campaigning for black candidates. Baraka recently completed his autobiography. His plays include The Dutchman, The Slave, and The Toilet, which shocked audiences in the 60s with their explicit language and their rage against the oppression of blacks in America. Baraka's books Black Music and Blues People are about jazz, which has always influenced the rhythms of his poetry and his style of reading. He read a couple of recent poems before we began the interview.
Okay, these are poems from a long book I'm writing called Wise. W-I-S-E, W-H-Y apostrophe S, or Y apostrophe S. If you ever find yourself somewhere, lost and surrounded by enemies who won't let you speak in your own language, who destroy your statues and instruments, who ban your boom baboom, then you are in trouble. Deep trouble. They ban your boom baboom, you in deep, deep trouble. Probably take you several hundred years to get out. Wise 3. Sun singing, found some words. Sun singing in that other language, talking about baby, why you leave me here, talking about up under the sun, cotton in my hand, sun singing, think he bad, cause he can speak they language, talking about dark was the night, the ocean deep, white eyes cut through me, made me weep, sun singing, found some words, think he bad, speak they language. It's all right, I say. It's all right with me. Look like, yeah, we gonna be here a taste.
Amiri Baraka told me that he grew up mostly in black neighborhoods, but he went to a predominantly white junior high and high school, so he learned how to get by in both black and white cultures, which he says most educated blacks know how to do.
Most educated black people by this time tend to be bicultural and bilingual, because you have to make it in society, therefore, to operate in society, you have to master, like that poem, you know, you think he bad, he speak their language. I mean, you have to master the kind of, elements that allow you to operate within the larger society. But at the same time, because of segregation, because of discrimination, because black people have never been allowed to melt in the melting pot, there is a great deal of continuity and wholeness to, you know, the African-American culture as an entity in itself, you know.
You went to Howard University,
yeah,
which is a black university,
yeah,
but you describe it in your autobiography as being blindingly yellow, blindingly yellow, and you said that it reeked of the stiffness and artificiality of that petty bourgeois Negro mentality. Can I ask you to explain what
sure
you mean?
Well, you know, I mean, the middle class of all nationalities tends to be asinine. And, you know, like you say, the middle class comes, I think, in two general sectors. You know, the one tends to be the lower middle class, who are very supportive of working people because they live next to them, they live with them, you know, they marry them, you know, they, you know, that's so that exchange is always based on the relationship that the working class has. And in a black community, the overwhelming majority of people are working people. Now, your mother and father might be middle class in the house, you know, but when you come outside, that's a whole other reality, you see. Now, Howard actually was a kind of conglomerate of all the worst kind of tendencies, you know, first the color consciousness, the kind of caste system, caste as class, you know, the doctor, lawyer, teacher, preacher syndrome. And I came from none of that, really, although we were, I guess, lower middle class. And my grandfather had been a big, a storekeeper in the South before the Klan burned him out. And then he owned a store in Newark before the Depression burned him out. But by that time, we were post that part of the middle class, and we had sort of tried to readjust to, father as a postman, mother as a social worker, grandfather as a night watchman type thing, which is a different thing.
You left Howard, I think, actually. Yeah. Did you flunk out of Howard?
Sure, I was kicked out. So I was kicked out about 5 or 6 times, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
And then you joined the Air Force.
Right.
And what was interesting to me is that you actually started becoming really interested in literature and started to become an intellectual when you were in the Air Force, which is not exactly what you... What I'd expect. How did that happen?
Well, what I'm saying, the middle class thing is not about education qua learning. It's about preparation for some kind of trade or vocation. The first Negro to do this or the last one makes no difference. But it's some kind of middle class description of the world and the relevance therein limited. But when I got to the Air Force, first of all, I felt drugged that I had even done that, because that was the stupidest thing I ever did in my life, get out of college and join the Air Force. But I had been thrown out of the middle class, that kind of a sanctuary of irrelevance that they inhabit, and I actually found myself now, set a new record for KP in the Air Force, I think about 22, 23 days straight. I had never fought before, anybody. Now I found myself always belting people in the head with different things. And I think what it was a kind of a reawakening in real life, actually finding yourself oppressed by America on the real side. And not really having that kind of refracted light of petty bourgeois aspiration between me and reality. It's just, this is what's happening, You got KP. I even saw guys I went to college with who are now officers, and I was walking around an airman, no class. And and I got into trouble in the Air Force, I got busted. I finally got thrown out of the Air Force. I would say, God, dog, I had struck out now twice. I got thrown out of college. Then I was going to join the Air Force. I got thrown out of the Air Force. So, it was really consistent. But the intellectual thing in the Air Force was I guarded airplanes, see? And there was nothing else to do 12 hours a day but read. And so I read everything I could possibly think of. The New York Times, a book review list. The bestseller list. I would see somebody's name in an article, and I would hunt it down. And then all those ghastly new critics were in power when I was coming up. So I found myself reading through, Ibsen and Eliot's hopeless essays and, the Southern Agrarians, the Sewanee Review, the Kenny, all manners of little garbage. But in retrospect, it was the kind of literature course one might get in the 50s when I was coming up. And I gave one to myself for 2 years and 6 months,
So you left the Air Force as a self-taught intellectual.
Right. I was kicked out of the Air Force, undesirable discharge. I was supposed to be a communist. At that time, I thought I was a Buddhist, but they had seen a copy of Partisan Review. And somebody, one of those, Southern sergeants thought that was some communism. You hear the way that boy talk, So it's very funny. But I was thrown out of the service anyway. I didn't mind.
After you were discharged from the service, you moved to the periphery of Greenwich Village and became a bohemian and entered the bohemian world. I'd really like to know what attracted you to that.
Well, you see, I thought really, because I guess I was the most unbohemian of all bohemians, my bohemianism consisted of not wanting to get involved with the stupid stuff that I thought people wanted you to get involved with, was namely America. You remember that was... Dwight Eisenhower, McCarthyism, and all those great things. And I had just been in some repressive situations, the middle class, black middle class college scene in the crazy United States Air Force. And so I just felt like getting out of that, And I thought now that I wanted to be a writer, I had something that I wanted to do that I was interested in doing. And so I wanted to pursue that, And so I moved down to East 3rd Street and 1st Avenue. Before it was the East Village, then it was just the Lower East Side. And, I paid $28 a month for this place with no heat. I wish it had heat. I didn't want to be that bohemian. And I used to stick my feet in the oven and put on my sweaters and try to write on a yellow pad every day,
You were hanging out also with a lot of the beat writers. There were a lot of painters in your circle.
Yeah.
And I think most of the people in the circle were white.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What was your standing within the circle as a black artist? Did it make you any different?
Well, see, most people in the village were and are white. Because it's like America. But I think in that sense, interestingly enough, the longer I stayed down there, you could see some visible changes in the society of the sort of Lower East Side, Greenwich Village society, that is, more and more black people began to come in. But no, I think for the most part, the people I hung with, we were all sort of, you know, on the outs. I mean, it was, I got to meet Ginsberg when I first came down to the Village because Howl had come out, you know, and I read it, and I think between Howl and James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, which I'd read the year before I got out of service, I thought those were the two books and the two authors that most turned me on at the time, Jimmy Baldwin and Allen Ginsberg. And so I wrote Ginsberg a letter. He was living in Paris. I wrote it on a piece of toilet paper, I guess to be dramatic, and asked him, you know, was he for real? You know, what is this? Is this for real or what is this, just a game? And he wrote me back a letter. We started correspondence, you know. But I think in the main, it was, there were a lot of people who were sincere, who were really trying to do something. I know we had come from different places, and because of that, we had different ideas, different aesthetics even. But I think in that circle, those people generally were fighting against the academic life, academic poetry of the 50s. Whether you were talking about Ginsberg and the Beats, or you're talking about Creeley and Olson and the Black Mountain School, or you're talking about Frank O'Hara and the New York School, as all these so-called schools, they were all, I think, aligned in a kind of united front against the dullness of the new critics and the dullness of the kind of poetry they're now trying to bring back, you know, the New Yorker-type poetry. Alas, the birdbath is overfilled or something like that, you know.
Your play, The Dutchman, was produced off-Broadway in 1964, I think
64,
it was.
64, yeah.
And it won an Obie Award.
Yeah.
It was very controversial. People mm-hmm. were, I think, very, very shocked at the sentiments being expressed,
yeah.
also some of the language being used. And it's about a white woman who provokes and finally kills mm-hmm. a black man. And at the time, you were married to a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you think that affected the fact that this was a white woman and a black man and that you were married to a white woman? Had that affect the way you were seen and the way your play was received?
Well, I think actually, I can tell you, I can give you a for instance that will clarify. Now, when I wrote that play, Dutchman, which is really, you know, coming to consciousness, you know, what are the dangers to the middle class, but particularly the black middle class intellectual, that is the contradiction between seduction, which is, the woman. I mean, because America advertises everything with the white woman. It could be peas or, you know, automobiles. But that is America the seductive. So the intellectual is always first, there's the attempted seduction. Come with me, you know, we're going to have a good time. You know, we're going to be together. But then if you refuse to do that, you are killed. That is, if you try to get off the train, if you say, no, I'm not going to do it. Now, black people, to me, it's obvious, you know. But I think intellectuals in general, it's also obvious. But I think the thing with me being married to a white woman at the time was that made it okay, I think, that sector of the establishment that deals with downtown. I think it made it okay. I think the next year, after I'd gotten a divorce and moved up to Harlem and we did the play up in Harlem, the play was termed Racist, where in 1964 it won Obie Award, Best American Play. I don't know how a play can change just because you take the A train to present it, but it did.
When you left the bohemian life and living in Greenwich Village, you moved up to Harlem.
And Harlem, yeah.
That was shortly after the assassination of Malcolm X.
Absolutely, yeah.
What did that move to you symbolize from going from the Village up to Harlem?
Well, first of all, as young, you know, as intellectuals, we took that very seriously. I mean, the question of murdering Malcolm was not just a public figure being killed. It was like somebody who we were sworn to be involved with and who had actually shaped our thinking, you know. I met Malcolm the month before he was killed. I mean, that was the second time I'd seen him. But, I mean, I talked to Malcolm one night with a brother named Muhammad Babu from Tanzania all night. And, you know, that added to what Malcolm had, with the things he had been saying throughout his brief, you know, kind of appearance as a leader in America. I mean, it deeply changed my mind about America. It made me see America in a way I had never. It made me see myself in a way I had never. And then for them to kill him, for a lot of us, it represented the declaration of war. And I think, you know, the very idea that, you know, here you are down in Greenwich Village fooling around, you know, I mean, I think I was at a book party that afternoon, you know. I mean, you know, just jiving around, although I guess I was as more active than most. But still, I mean, it was the thing is, but what does this mean? I mean, what is this as a commitment to the people themselves. And you see, I think one thing about the Dutchman thing itself that people never really understand is when that came out and I discovered that they were going to make me famous, it changed my whole personality, or it began to emphasize another aspect of personality, because until then I thought it was all right for me to just hang out and do anything I wanted to, because after all, you know, there was, I didn't feel any sense of responsibility, I guess that's what it was. But I mean, the sense of responsibility, that is, if somebody's going to stand you up in front of a microphone or a TV, you see what I mean, and they say, what are you going to say? Then I have to remember what my grandmother told me about, you know, how they killed this little boy, at 16, and cut off his genitals and stuffed them in his mouth and made all the little girls, black girls in town, come to watch that. And, you know, why she told me that when I was 10 years old, because she wanted me to know where I was. Then I have to remember that. I can't waste that. You know, I have to remember what happened to my grandfather, you know, how my mother and father struggled. I can't waste that. You know what I mean? I can't be a person who's now going to pretend that those things didn't really shape me in some kind of profound way, you see? So I have to say, I have to talk about those things. And to talk about those things in America is to be radical, just to talk about them.
So you felt that you really had a certain responsibility, knowing that you were going to be famous, to use to use that celebrity to address issues that you thought were really important.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just using it
just to hang out. That's right. And why that happened to me, sometimes I wonder. But it did. I mean, I went to the corner that night and read all these reviews of Dutchman, what they were putting him down. A man's crazy, this terrible language, a foul-mouthed, sick person. But what was interesting to me is that how much ink and how, you know, violent these attacks were, in that they really, that what I had said was really hurt them in some kind of way, that that what I had said had really reached some kind of if not the funny bone, the terror bone, because there were reactions that were very interesting to me. I said, these people are really don't like this, and even though they're putting me down as a nut, it's obviously that they want to continue to do that because they don't want this trend of thought to continue. See what I'm saying? So I knew that I said, oh, so they're going to keep calling me a nut. The more they're going to keep calling me a nut, apparently they're going to make me famous. And then they started asking me to do all these things, you know, rewrite Golden Boy, write Cotton Comes to Harlem. Huh? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Write Cotton Comes to Harlem. All kinds of wild things.
Did you do any of those things?
No, I didn't do it. Mostly because I was very, self-serving. Maybe I didn't feel like, I didn't have to do any of that. You know, I thought that it was young. That's youth. Because anything that anyone said to me that I didn't like, you know, I would tell them. I remember when Leonard Bernstein came and wanted to do the music for The Toilet, after The Toilet opened. And, you should jump at that. That's a great opportunity. You know, hey, Leonard Bernstein wants to do the music for The Toilet. Solid. Get right in there. But instead of that, I sat there and insulted him. You know, I asked him, did he think he was as good a composer as Duke Ellington? Did he think he was as good a piano player as Duke Ellington? I said, man, you don't even dress as good as Duke Ellington. Now, that's not necessary to say all that, but that's why the rep goes with that. Because I guess what that was is a young boy really beginning to test his strength. And in that kind of period there, and the kind of militance and nationalism that I was growing into, I thought that those kinds of things were necessary. I mean, I thought that Leonard obviously is a fine person in many ways. It's just that I don't think I was completely ready emotionally for the responsibility that I now thought I had.
Did you think it was very important during that period to assert both to the outside world and to yourself your own blackness, especially having come
from an integrated absolutely
people,
that's the I think Fanon talks about that in The Wretched of the Earth. He says the native intellectual usually goes through these stages first, the super integration period, where you look up and you find yourself whiter than white. I mean, you find you have been colonized within an inch of your life, and then almost as embarrassment, you know, the second stage then is return to the native. You become super super African, you know. And then the third stage, hopefully, if you get there, is you can try to bring those two things together and take a revolutionary stance. Hopefully I've come to the last part of that.
My guest is poet, playwright, and essayist Amiri Baraka. After living in Harlem for a while, you moved to Newark, which is where you grew up. Did that feel like going home again?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in Newark. I left, to go away to college. But I came back to Newark because I knew that that was where I began, and New York for me had you know, had got old suddenly. There was nothing really I could do there. I mean, I could not see myself doing anything more in New York except, you know, laying back and cooling out. And so I went back really to Newark because I thought if any place I could get some kind of, you know, readdress with myself, if you would, you know.
Can you explain the reasons for your name change from Leroy Jones to Amiri Baraka?
Well, I'll tell you. It had to do with why should I be an American? Why should I be identified? Well, even a Frenchman. But why should I be identified with that when I should do something to identify with my own real roots? And so the man who buried Malcolm X, this, you know, Muslim imam, priest, he, after I'd gotten beat up by the police during the rebellion, he came to me and he said, you need a... You don't need this American name. And I was susceptible to it at the time because God knows, I mean, I'd just gotten whipped near to death. And so he gave me an Arab name. He gave me the name Amir Barakat. But I didn't want an Arab name. And because we began to go into Kawaida, the kind of cultural value system organization that Ron Karinga was pushing on the West Coast, then I took that name in Swahili eyes, or Bantu eyes, and changed it from Amir to Amiri, and from Barakat to Baraka to make it a Swahili name, the same kind of name you'd find in Tanzania, Uganda, or Kenya. And now, of course, I'm no longer in a cultural nationalist movement, but I'd be the only one in my family with an American name. All my kids, my five kids, you know, Obalaji, Raz, Shani, Midi, and Ahi. I mean, I'd be sapped to be walking around still Leroy.
I think it was in your autobiography that you wrote that you and your wife, Amina, had attended together the University of Fake Blackness.
Mm-hmm.
Would you explain what you meant?
Well, I meant we went through those cultural nationalist organizations, you know. We were exposed to all kinds of charlatans. We were exposed to all kinds of great people. But in a sense, we went through the whole nationalist period together. We went through cultural nationalism together, and we came out on the other side.
I know that some people think, why is it that you've gone from believing in mm-hmm. one system and then renouncing that for another system, and now you're a socialist, which is yet
sure.
another system,
sure.
instead of abandoning a movement or a system or an ideology mm-hmm. and becoming an independent, so to speak?
Well, that's anarchism. I studied anarchy, too, you know, but it's, anarchy...
Well, but anarchy yeah. is even another movement or another system
exactly.
in a way. But
exactly.
I mean, like,
it's
having no system and being an independent...
Because you can't, really. If you could be independent... Then there'll be no such thing as national oppression. See, the point is, you can be independent only if you close your eyes to the fact that there are other people just like you who cannot be independent. You see, and I don't think you can use your consciousness to cover the fact that you're not trying to raise the level of everyone's consciousness.
Your life has changed many different times over the years. The circle you've traveled in has changed. Your location has changed. Your ideology has changed.
Yeah.
But one thing that's really remained a constant, I think, throughout your life is the power of music and the importance of it to you ever since you were young. Can you just explain the importance of music in your life?
Well, you grow up, you know, in a black community, you grow up surrounded by music. I mean, because African-American people, because they are repressed in so many areas, music has been one area, and athletics, as we see, that they've been allowed to develop to a certain extent. And so you grow up with that kind of context of all kinds of music. My parents loved Nat King Cole. We had all his albums before he started singing. I'm not talking about Nat King Cole the singer. I'm talking about when he had the Nat King Cole Trio. They were great, you know, Count Basie fans. And then the blues, which is constant. I mean, Dinah Washington, Ruth Brown. And then my grandfather and grandmother, they liked the older blues even, you know. And then, of course, being a teenager, the blues was our language. I mean, the rhythm and blues, all those Bird quartets, the Ravens, the Orioles, you know, and all those, the Dominoes. So you grow up in a world of black music, but at the same time, you're in America, you see. So you're gonna get all of that, see what I'm saying?
Did you ever take music lessons or
constantly,
learn an instrument?
Constantly. I was always taking music lessons. I did piano lessons I didn't like. I took, what else? Drum lessons, which I didn't like, and I took trumpet lessons, which I liked. But then at the time when I could have blossomed, I guess, into a trumpet player, I stopped playing the trumpet for some reason. When I went away to college, I stopped playing the trumpet for some reason. I don't know why. But I liked the trumpet at the time because my heroes then were trumpet players. They had, you know, I had just begun to, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, of course, was my first hero, and then Miles Davis. And they were trumpet players, you know, so I identified with them very heavily, you know.
Did your teachers The people who you were studying with know about jazz and rhythm and blues, or were they teaching you music you didn't much like?
Well, they would teach. You know, I had this Italian trumpeter. He was a great trumpet teacher, but he wanted you to play like you were playing, you know, Verdi or something like that. You know, and he gave me this Rudy Muck mouthpiece. I'd be making these C above high C, you know, pop 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 pop, and I didn't really want to play like that. So he had fixed me up, so I had to play like that. So in order to play like Miles, I had to slide the horn around to the side of my mouth, which probably ruined my armature forever.
Did you ever wish you were a musician?
All the time, all the time. I always wanted to be a musician. When growing up, I really was drawn to the music. I think the only thing that stopped me from becoming a musician was the fact that I didn't do it, and I didn't do it because I knew there was something else I wanted to do, which was right, apparently.
Well, you've written many poems about jazz, and I'd like for you to read one for us now.
Okay, I have this poem written quite a few back, and it's about Miles Davis. That is, when I first started listening to Miles Davis, when I used to deliver groceries in Newark. It's called Early Cool. Miles, blues, who's little boy with a trumpet bag on High Street bopping? Day of promises and blue transparent stone shining inside you low and cool, glissando, the runs of notes. Each one speaks a path beyond the ghetto sun. Blue bops speak to us as a guiding laughter, heating our hip young walk down the street to poetry land. So Venus de Milo was beauty, after all. Black marble, hey blow, muted slickness, jaunty one, African things. Black Venus in us, blue light soft like Earth's immemorial laughter. Hey, Miles, master of blue light and the turn, hand on hip, the horn hung ready. Hey, Miles, my man, blue light and the whirring metal groove.
We've talked a little bit about how you've gone through different stages in your life, and you've even gone through different names in your life. How do you feel about the work that you've written in earlier periods, the work I'm thinking that was written under your first name of Leroy Jones? Do you feel alienated from that work, or do you still feel connected to it?
No, I don't get uptight about it because I'm not him anymore. You know what I mean? I look at it try to look at it objectively. Obviously, some stuff I wish I hadn't done, some stuff I'm embarrassed by because I am Leroy Jones. But I think I tend to approach it as an artifact. I did that then. I try to understand what I was doing, why I thought what I thought, why I wrote what I wrote. And, keep stepping. I don't have any kind of wound-worshipping complex about it. No, not at all.
That was poet, playwright, and essayist Amiri Baraka, who was formerly known as Leroy Jones. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Joyce Lieberman and Ron Barron. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.